Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. At recent times, we've sort of had a wealth of Blaneys. As you know, Anne Blaney addressed the Institute on a book on Charles Kingsford Smith recently, and that was a return visit. And Geoffrey Blaney, a longtime friend, as Anne has been of the Sydney Institute, is here on the occasion of the publication of his most recent book, Before I Forget, an early memoir. Now, Geoffrey is one of the best-known Australian commentators and writers, so I won't introduce him, except to say it's great that he's got a new book out, and we're going to hear him talk on Before I Forget. So let's start Before He Forgets. Geoffrey.
Jared, members and guests, thanks very much, Jared. I thought about the year 2000 that I'd write something about my life, partly because I wanted to recapture something that had largely vanished. But I thought that, like so many people I knew, my memory might go or fade. And so I began to write the story of my childhood. And after I'd finished that, I thought I'd add some chapters on learning to be a historian. And I got to about the age of 40 or 41, and suddenly I stopped. I don't know why. Perhaps I'd said all I wanted to say, or perhaps I thought, Gerard, I was entering perilous seas. And so I put it aside and didn't take it up again, perhaps 2 or 3 years ago. I think my memory is still fairly good, but the first thing you can say about memory is it is infallible. Somebody once said that memory is an unskilled worker, and sometimes after I'd written a section, I thought, well, how do I know that's true? I used to keep diaries when I was very little. You know, we were often given a diary for a New Year's Day present, and we were very clever if we continued the diary until school began 4 weeks later. But I used to keep diaries, just a few notes, for most of my life, and I kept a lot of letters so that I checked up things, and sometimes I found my memory was very much astray. I don't mention in the book the places which I found out were astray because I altered them. My father was a Methodist minister, and the Methodists then held about 1/8 of the population, the same number as the Presbyterians. But the Methodists were different. The clergymen were not allowed to stay with the same congregation for more than about 4 years. So that I spent my first 3 years at Terang in the Western District of Victoria, and then we moved to Leongatha in Gippsland, a dairying town much smaller than it is today. And my first memories are of Leongatha. I was so infatuated by Leongatha and the life there that for many years my ambition was to be a dairy farmer. It was the only occupation I knew, and I learned how to milk a cow at the various families that we visited, and I couldn't have possibly coped if fortune had favoured me and I was given some money and I bought a dairy farm. I just couldn't have coped because in those days most dairy farmers had very little mechanical equipment, but increasingly dairying, like all farming activities, required technical skills. You just couldn't afford to bring in a man from the nearest town to mend your car or anything like that. And so I eventually lost the desire to be a dairy farmer. I had one great advantage at Leongatha Primary School. I attended, I think, for 2 years, but we learned everything by chanting. We started with 2 times 2 is 4, and then 4 times 4 is 16. And then we moved to geography, Melbourne on the Arrow London on the Thames, we moved on to spelling, and we chanted all day long. And I think children are very happy to do what the other children are doing until they become more curious at about the age of 7 or 8. But I got a wonderful grounding at Leongatha, and I'm very grateful to the school for that grounding. We then moved in 1937 to Geelong, which was then a relatively small city with only 45,000 people, the signs at the entrance to Geelong used to say. The first momentous thing that happened in Geelong was that we went to a church in Packington Street called the Newtown Methodist Church, and it was a great footballing church in Geelong. I don't mean they were all footballers, but the most famous footballing family in Geelong in that era were called the Rankins. And Ted Rankin was quite famous in football history, not only for playing a huge number of games, but he invented the idea that on a wet day, when you couldn't bounce the ball when you were running, because the ball was slippery and the grounds were often undrained, but he invented the idea every 10 or 15 yards of bending over and touching the ball on the ground. And the umpires, surprised, agreed that this was fair enough, and so that great innovation took over the game, and now you rarely see it because the grounds are so well drained. At the age of 7, my father, who was a very devoted pastoral worker, believed in following every activity that his congregation was interested in, so we went to the Cryo Oval. It's vanished completely, the Geelong football ground of that era. Nothing has left the mounds, the goalposts, the grandstands. It was by the botanical gardens and down by the marshes, and it's gone completely. But there we were, standing in the outer, and I thought it was such a pretty sight because football in those days was more like chess, and the players started out in very set positions. And when the game began and after each goal, they set out in, they were in some kind of symmetry. I thought South Melbourne, now Sydney, of course, had the prettiest colours. They were red and white, and I began to call out for South Melbourne. My father said, we're in Geelong now. and we have to keep on living here. So I became a Geelong supporter. Mr. Rankin was very good to us. At our church, he said we should have a junior cricket team, under 14 or under 16. He was the groundsman at the Geelong College, and he borrowed bats and pads and stumps and old cricket balls, and we formed a team, I suppose it was in the under-16 Protestant Association. He really fathered us, and when we played their matches, we didn't know the rules or anything, and we didn't realise that you had to appeal if something debatable had taken place. How's that? And he drew us all together after a while and explained that we had to shout out, "How's that?" which we all learned very quickly. It was one of the few things we learned quickly, our scores being low. And we then, I had a great experience at Geelong. It wasn't great for our nation, but for a child it was great. In 1940, the war entered a very difficult stage. Germany invaded France and knocked out France with lightning speed. It's really one of the most astonishing events in 20th century history. Here was Germany and France fighting one another again, and the German tactics in the German Army and Air Force were so skilled that in the space of 1 month, they covered virtually the northern half of France, swept over the battlefields where the war had been static in 1914, 15, 16, 17, 18, and France was knocked out of the war. This was one of the reasons, incidentally, perhaps the main reason why Singapore fell. We forget that the main aim of the British and the French was that the Germans should enter the war, and then the Japanese should enter the war in the Pacific. It was most important to defend Singapore. And the plan was that if the Japanese attacked Singapore, well, the French Navy would command the Mediterranean and the North Atlantic, while the British Navy, nearly all the British Navy, the aircraft carriers, went past the Cape of Good Hope to Singapore. And it was believed that their arrival would save Singapore. Well, of course, France was knocked out of the war. The Navy was no longer in the command of the Allies, and there was virtually no hope that Singapore would be saved. So I had a newspaper round. On Saturdays, I used to go to the railway station at Geelong at about 6 o'clock, and the Geelong Express came in and they brought in the last edition of the Herald with the late scores printed in red on the front page under the heading was a stop press.
Yes.
And then the Sporting Globe also came with the, almost the late scores. The Sporting Globe was published on pink print paper. And I would get these big bundles and put them on my handlebars and take them to the newsagent, Mr. Chapman. Everybody was called Mr. in those days. And he would divide them into bundles. I then had my bundle and I had to go to West Geelong, and it was quite a stirring sight in retrospect, because the Battle of Britain was on. And the question was whether Britain or Germany would win the aerial battle for Britain. And the headlines day after day said how many German planes had been shot down. We didn't know at the time that those figures were probably exaggerated, but morale had to be kept up. And it was amazing, standing at the gate were people, sometimes with a lantern, often with money, but some who didn't need to pay money because they were regular customers, and they would snatch the newspaper and turn to it so quickly to see what the headlines were. I think in those days the ABC didn't have radio news, and the commercial stations weren't much into news, so that the newspapers were all important. And I had this profound sense of knowing about important events, which of course I didn't understand. Being a mimic, I thought I must invent a game that was based on war, and we had a section of our backyard where no activity took place, so I turned that, with my father's permission, into a battlefield. And only having read really about the First World War, I cut little trenches across the sandy soil, and I put up sticks, which I suppose were meant to be barbed wire or tank traps, I don't know, but that was my understanding of the war at the time. We then moved to Ballarat, and I think in 1941, and I think that had a profound effect on my life. I had some idea, without knowing how to express it, that I'd like to be write, but of course I had nothing to write about and no skills to be a writer. But in Ballarat, I somehow gained the sense that there was another world and that the world had vanished. And when in the Ballarat streets one would see the mullock dumps, the remains of the gold mines that had been dug in the 19th century, and when we saw remarkable 19th century buildings and statues, Ballarat still has the great seat of statues in all Australia. So that Ballarat does convey a sense of history. And there I had some desire, or some link with history for the first time, and some desire that someday I would like to write about it. By good fortune, there was a very wealthy man in Geelong. His name was Howard Hitchcock. He had a store rather like Myers, a small version of Myers. He was very rich and he was very generous. And it was his idea, Mr. Howard Hitchcock, that there should be a Great Ocean Road. And after the war was over, he began to put in money and to collect money. And largely ex-soldiers who are unemployed began to build what is now becoming one of the great tourist sites of the world. He died long before it was finished, but when they opened the first section, it must have been rather moving, because he still had... He's dead, but his car was in the garage and the man who used to drive him was still alive. And the first section of the Great Open Road was opened with a procession, with the driver in the front seat, the empty passenger seat where Mr. Howard Hitchcock would have sat. He set up a scholarship, or his trustees did, which said that so that a boy could go to Wesley College in Melbourne, he provided this scholarship. It paid boarding fees and accommodation fees and fees for books and train fares to the school and pocket money. It must have been the most generous secondary school scholarship ever set up in Australia. And it was only available to sons of Methodist ministers aged 13, living more than 30 miles from Melbourne. Even my dad, who was rather weary, said I probably had a good chance. And so it came to pass, but there were five children in the family, and in those days the churches, Catholic and Protestants, served as a kind of a welfare state, and the demands on the church and the families were very large, and my father wasn't sure whether it would be fair to accept it, because there might be hidden expenses come up. And it was cutting the nature strip, I suppose you'd call it, in the days before the Honda motor mower came in. And it was Saturday afternoon, and a member of the congregation, or he had been a member of the congregation, and he left over some theological upheaval to go to another church. But we were friendly with the family, and he walked past, and my father said that one of the boys had won a scholarship. And my father said he wasn't sure whether he could take it up, because the hidden expenses might be very difficult to meet. The man who won the Milledge Medal in the First World War walked about 100 paces up the hill to his home and came back with, I don't know what the sum was, but either the largest possible banknote or several banknotes, and gave them to my father. My father was so astonished and so grateful that somebody who had really departed from the congregation in some upheaval should do such a generous act. So my father sent the telegram to the Wesley College and accepted it, and so I went there. The headmaster, incidentally, was the man who'd founded Knox College here, Mr. Neil Harcourt McNeil. He'd been brought to Wesley because Wesley then was seen as very run down, and somebody from Sydney might be able to straighten it up. I was very fortunate to go to the school, because Ballarat High School, which I attended, was a very good school, but Wesley College, the boys were much more competitive. I think you learn so much from the people of your own age group, and often you learn attitudes to work that you can't be given by those who teach you directly. You learn so much from your own generation. That's why education in Australia is so ineffective at the moment. The generation, the youngest generation, has broken away to some extent and are influenced by other teachers than those that preside over the classroom. Anyhow, I went to school there and had some people who influenced me very strongly, and I'm very grateful to them. The English master was named Mr. Phillips, Mr. A.A. Phillips. He later became very well known because he invented the phrase the cultural cringe, and it became very well known, and all kinds of politicians, ranging from Mr. Keating to National Party leaders, found themselves using the phrase. He used to mark essays. It's a wonderful gift, a teacher who'll mark essays and knows how to mark them. And I came down with a kind of a Ballarat prose style, with a lot of words, and Mr. Phillips, marking my essays, would read them carefully and mark on the margin. He left a wide margin, or he told us to leave a wide margin of comments, and he would write down flabby or prose. He did that until I learned to write tightly. I still believe I write tightly, but I owe him an enormous debt of gratitude. In fact, when he became, I suppose, in his mid-80s, I heard that he was in a big hospital in the suburbs of Melbourne, and hearing he was in a bad way, I went out to see him. I had very little contact with him many years, and I found him jumping out of bed and putting on an old football jumper, and he thanked me for coming, and he then said, after a while, he said, I've got cancer, he said, without any sense of pity. It's incurable. I think he said to me, would I say something at his funeral? I think he said it to me. And I suppose I nodded, and he died a couple of days later. And so I spoke at his funeral in the Queen's College Chapel, a building which I suspect he'd never entered. But I pay tribute to all those people who taught me. When I was a student at Melbourne University, I started out doing law, but I didn't find it interesting. I found history much more interesting, and so I did history. I had this burning desire to write, and I became editor of the student newspaper, unpaid in those days. The newspaper was called Frago. It was an 8-page newspaper which was printed very professionally by the Argus, the Melbourne Daily of the 1840s, then in its dying stages. And that was a wonderful experience to me. I didn't know what I'd write or how I'd become writer, but a remarkable thing happened. in the Melbourne History School, which was then led by a distinguished Sydney scholar, R.M. Crawford, the brother of Sir John Crawford, who was so important in Canberra for many years. And Max Crawford, R.M. Crawford, became Professor of History at Melbourne at the age of, I think, 31. He built up what people said at the time was the best history school in Australia, and I suspect that was true, but he was very helpful. And when I was offered a job as a tutor, I said no, whatever the words I used. He was expressed astonishment. Everybody wanted to be a tutor, and I said I wanted to be a writer. And he found out from a lady who used to come to tutorials that her husband was on the board of a big mining company on the west coast of Tasmania, the Mount Lyell Mining and Railway Company. And so I went over there, and for a year I received a small payment from the university and a small payment from the mining company. And then I worked for 2 years as a geology officer, and I learned to write a book, and I wrote my first book. I was very lucky. It was on a mining field with a most remarkable history. There took place in 1912 the worst mining disaster has ever taken place in a metalliferous mine in Australia. Several of the coal mines in New South Wales and Mount Mulligan in North Queensland have had worse disasters in terms of loss of life, but of all the gold mines and copper and silver, lead and so forth mines in Australia, Mount Lyell has had the worst disaster. Large numbers of men were trapped underground when the woodwork in the mine caught fire and fumes, deadly fumes, were set going. Large numbers of men were underground for 5 days, and there was great doubts whether they would ever get them out again. In the end, 42 men lost their lives. They had the centenary of the event. I was one of the speakers. All except one were buried at Mount Lyell, and a huge crowd assembled there in 2012 in a great square. No building, no roofing or anything in this rather distraught valley. It was one of the most moving sights you can imagine. Nowadays we have grief healers and all kinds of social services, but it's remarkable to think that in those days, isolated towns, they cope with their own disasters, they cope with their own grief. You know, they made things happen, and so the event slowly receded from memory. And that was my first book. I must watch my steps out of this time. Time for questions. It was published in 1954. You were so lucky if you were a young writer in the 1950s. Nowadays, when there are hundreds or thousands of people doing PhDs on history or history-like subjects, you can write a very good book. It can really be an outstanding book, but it will not be reviewed in a daily newspaper. It might be reviewed in a specialist journal, but very hard to get publicity. In those days, few books came out on Australian history, and my book, which was called The Peaks of Lyell, it was reviewed, I would think, in every daily newspaper in Australia. It would be astonishing if there was any paper that missed it, and even small town papers like Leongatha and Trangan, no doubt, reviewed the book. That was a great thing to happen when you were young in those days, and I think how fortunate I was. I had a great desire to be a historian, and I made my living writing history, sometimes perilous, as Anne, my wife, will testify, but I learnt my trade. History is a skilled trade. It's like any other trade, no matter what we say, history, and virtually all the things that we like or admire, they're skilled trades, and you learn largely by doing them. You learn largely by experience. I was so absorbed in the history of Australia, there were so many topics about which nobody had written, that I enjoyed it enormously. I had no wish to go abroad. I thought I would spend my whole life in Australia and just writing about Australian history. One day I was writing, finishing the memoirs of a very distinguished Australian, largely unknown, named W.S. Robinson. He wrote his memoirs but didn't finish them, and he told everybody he'd finished them. And the head of CRA, now Rio Tinto, said to me, "Do you think you could finish them anonymously?" And I said, "I'll do my best." I learnt his prose style, and eventually I finished them. He had such great international influence. This is a tiny testimony. After he died, a Bible came, an old Bible came to the Scotch College in Melbourne. inscribed by Winston Churchill and Brendan Bracken, who was his Minister for Information, thanking W.S. Robinson for his services innumerable. It was really incredibly influential. When Australia was desperately short of aircraft, Mr. McEwen, who later was Deputy Prime Minister, said to me he met W.S. Robinson in the dark days of the war, and Robinson said, "I'm going to the United States for a few weeks. Very difficult to get there. Is there anything you want done?" And McEwen said, "We need warplanes desperately." And to his astonishment, a message came back from California from Robinson saying, "I've got 42. Incredible. And they came back to Australia at a time when Australia was so desperate. Anyhow, Sir Maurice Morby, who was then the chairman of Broken Hill Boy, chairman of CRA now, Rio Tinto, he said, "You must go overseas and meet the people Robinson knew." I said, "Well, I'm writing Robinson's view of the world, not my view of Robinson." He said, "You should go." He said, "We'll pay for everything." I went home and I said to Anne, my wife, Murray Morby said, if we wanted to go overseas, he'd pay for us and he'd pay for you and it wouldn't cost us anything. We could stay away for 2 months if we liked. I said, I was inclined to say no. Anne said, "Not on your life." So we went overseas for the first time, and of course it changes one's life. I think I was 34. I thought of it today. I was at lunchtime. I hired a cab and got talking to the man. It was about a 30-minute ride, and he was about 65. I thought he was 60, and I thought he was Chinese. I said, "Do you come from China?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Where do you come from?" Oh, he said, "I come from Fujian, which is opposite Taiwan." We got talking, and he said, "Have you been to China?" I said, "Yes, I have been to China." He said, "When did you first go there?" I said, "In 1966. His hands left his steering wheel, and he gave such a shout of astonishment because it was the Cultural Revolution just beginning. And by chance, I was there in China, having no idea what happened, no foreigners there, and not knowing about this tumultuous event that was taking place. And I thought that today, fancy, I wouldn't have conceived when I was young that I would ever go overseas. And here I was in China at this time. I wrote a book about it, Crossing the Red World. And I went actually from Hong Kong to what they used to call Canton and Beijing, and then with difficulty I got a visa to Mongolia and then to Siberia and so forth, and got all the way to Holland. I wrote a book about it, Across the Red World. I must finish. I can say just one word about China. It's the most interesting question, isn't it? Who would have guessed, even in 1980, I was chairman of the first Australia-China Council. Mr. Fraser asked me to do it, and I used to go to China quite often, and I couldn't conceive of China becoming an economic power. If you went into the countryside, there would be a great farmyard, a collective farmyard, and there might be 80 or 90 men with sticks flailing the stalks of grain so that the grain would break away from the stalk. 80, and incredibly inefficient, even by the standards of Australia in 1840, it was inefficient. Sometimes, if you were in a train and you looked out, there would be a woman with two geese, a job all day minding two geese. I mean, it's not what the Australian Productivity Commission would say an advanced form of economic activity. And here now is this country of enormous economic power. You just couldn't conceive of it. I suppose it's fair to say that it's going to remain a difficult issue for Australia for a long time. China is an authoritarian nation, I think much more advanced than was the Soviet Union in its heyday, but an authoritarian nation, and that's its own ideology, and we've known that for a long time, and therefore any ideas that are contrary to the government idea, whether it's the Uyghurs in the northwest who are hankering for some form of independence, whether the increasing number of Christians, and I think now there are more Christians in China than in Italy, the Christians worshipping largely in semi-underground conditions in house churches, when you think of the present conditions or troubles in Hong Kong. Something like this is bound to happen from time to time, and we shouldn't really be surprised. And I suppose the other interesting thing about China is that in some ways it's such a success story. You know, nobody here, I would think, if asked in 1990 or 2000, if there's a major economic recession, such as the world experienced in 2007 and 2008, if there's a major economic recession, who could conceive that China would emerge from that recession in better form than in the United States, which is the stronghold of experience we saw in all commercial and mercantile and economic activity. So it's a different kind of communist society than the society that in one sense flourished for a while in the Soviet Union, but eventually failed because it wasn't economically, I see a former head of the Reserve Bank blinking, but was economically nowhere near as worth talking about. So this is going to happen, and but we just have to learn about these other societies and not be so surprised at what happens in those societies in times of crisis. The good fortune, of course, is that the good fortune for Chinese is that an authoritarian society is much more skilled at finding out new technologies and technological secrets than a democratic society is skilled in defending the retention of those secrets. There's no doubt about it that the United States is still the most inventive, most innovative nation in the world. Whether it will remain so, we don't know, but the big disadvantage of the United States, and this, I assume, is the heart of the prolonged trade talks between the Chinese president or the head of the Communist Party and Mr. Trump. This is the key matter, isn't it? Is China going to continue to take over these technologies without paying much for them and the United States doing nothing about it? This problem is going to continue for some time, but I think fortunately, while China will before long pass the United States in total economic power, though far from taking over in the standard of living, China will have this great economy, but there's no doubt about it that China, as far as we know, in defence and military skills, is still a long way behind the United States, but it will be a matter that absorbs us for a long time to come. All this was of no interest to me when my dying wish was to be a dairy farmer. Not realising that to be a dairy farmer, I would have to sell milk and butter and cheese to China.
Well, many thanks to Geoffrey Blaney, as I said before, on the occasion of Before I Forget, an early memoir. And we've got copies for sale, and I'm sure Geoffrey Blaney would be happy to sign copies after the event. So we'll come to questions and discussion. You've spoken about, I mean, there's a lot of material in your book that some you've covered, some you haven't. You've only had 30 minutes, but you spoke about the history school at Melbourne University, and you mentioned Max Crawford. Now, he was a famous one from that school, so were you later on, and so was Manning Clark for a period before he went to Canberra. So what was your relationship with Manning Clark?
I went to Manning Clark's lectures in 1949. He lectured twice a week on Australian history in quite a large theatre, and he lectured, I think, at 5:15, because in those days so many students were working in the town and would come up in the tram to do their lectures part-time. He'd written virtually nothing on Australian history then. He'd written a book of documents, a collection of past events, but I don't think he'd written a book himself in his own right. But he was working very hard on research, and in those days when so few people were researching Australian history, I suspect that he knew more than almost anybody about the history of Australia since 1788. So he was very interesting to listen to, because you knew you were in the presence of somebody who was in the advance guard of research. He was only there for 1 year, and then he went to Canberra University College, didn't he, to take the chair of history. But we got on well, and he was very encouraging of me as a writer, and he marked two of my essays and was very generous, you feel very grateful when you're young for the people who give you encouragement. It's the greatest gift you can receive when you're young, isn't it? So I always will feel grateful to him. I didn't see him very often. Well, once I launched a book for him, but when I became the chairman of the Literature Board under the Whitlam government, I suggested that he should be a member, and they appointed him. So I saw quite a lot of him in the 1970s. He used to send me occasionally postcards. They were very short postcards with a short message. For a long period, he signed them Jesselenko. Jesselenko was a Carlton footballer, Canberra-born. He must have been the personage that Manny Clark would like to have been in another life. And occasionally he sent me a postcard from Tasmania signed Abel Tasman. I knew that it must have been in Australia Post for a long time. So in the 1980s we began to not see the world in the same way, but I continued to respect him. And
Briefly, your history writing was dramatically different, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. We saw the world quite differently, increasingly, not only current day national and international politics in the 1980s, but we saw Australia differently. My view is that the story of Australia is a success story. Many failings, which we acknowledge, many failings, but Australia by and large is a success story, and that's why we have such an immigration border protection problem. But Manning thought so much in Australian history was bad, and he regretted so much that happened. So our view of the world differed. I think I say in the book that we continued to travel comfortably on the same train, but we got off at different stations.
Now we've only got one microphone working tonight, so we've got to pass around. Lindsay Ellison.
Thank you for your talk. I think we're honoured by your presence. I want to follow up some of your comments. The last couple of decades, we've had what have been described as the history wars, and one side of history is sort of called the black armband story. Is that something you saw developing in the 40s and 50s, or is it a recent phenomenon?
I coined the phrase black armband view of history, and I coined it at Sydney University in the early 1990s in a lecture in honour of Sir John Hatham, who'd been the Chief Justice of the High Court. And I said that when I was youngish and writing history for the first time, I thought that the history of Australia was extremely congratulatory, and that's understandable because during the wartime you can only win a war, you can only maintain your morale high if you value the country you're defending. And the history profession recognised that fact. And whether historians were left-wing or right-wing, they believed their country was worth defending, and the people who sacrificed their lives were deserving of praise. But then we moved later on to a period where people felt, you know, ashamed of Australian history. They said that, you know, the treatment of the environment was terrible. Well, in some ways it was, but of course the Aborigines, contrary to the statements they make at the daily ceremonies we attend, they weren't really custodians of the land. No human being can be custodian of the land. Nature is infinitely stronger than human beings. And so we moved to this situation where we saw Aboriginal traditional life, which had many virtues, but they saw only it as a paradise. And they believed that it was very easy to save the environment, but of course it's not easy to save the environment and to maintain jobs for all and economic development. So I call that the black armband view of history, and that phrase has lasted. People see it as anti-Aboriginal. Of course, it's in no way anti-Aboriginal, and the speech I made in honour of Sir John Latham was high in praise of the skills the Aborigines had in a very difficult physical environment. So I think the history wars is as exaggerated as a phrase. You know, in all forms of intellectual activity, there are fierce debates in which friendships are broken and very strong adjectives are used. This has happened in what they could call the climate wars. Those of you who remember when continental drift in the 1960s was a great controversy, there was an extreme war fought between geologists, all science and the humanities are full of disagreements. You only learn by disagreement, but by the ability to clarify and express your disagreement. So that I don't think history is unique, but there is a sense in which in Australia, much more than, say, Britain or France or the United States, history is an important arbiter in the current debates. I mean, it's a Republican debate. It's a debate, isn't it? A debate about history. The debate, so much of politics is about what's the role of the Commonwealth and what's the role of the states. All kinds of important questions have got a very strong historical component, and that's especially true of Australia at the moment, and especially true of the question of Aborigines and their way of life and Europeans and their way of life. I think the sad thing is, the saddest thing is not that the debate takes place, but that important areas of evidence are not even considered safe to investigate. That's wrong. You know, democracy is governed by discussion, and it's very sad on important Aboriginal or European issues that clear-cut evidence that there can be no doubt whatsoever is regarded as out of bounds, and one side won't look at it. I mean, we hear again and again people say it's terrible that the Aborigines weren't considered worth counting in the census, and this is said again and again. And if I were an Aborigine, I'd say, well, that's terrible, fancy that happening. I'm a human being. Why don't they count me? But I've looked up the censuses since 1901, and there have been more censuses that count Aborigines than count other Australians. How can you possibly allow a heresy like this to be undiscussable? That's when a history war becomes a war rather than a serious discussion where the facts are the facts that are important. I say, make that statement with respect to all those who take part in the debate as persons.
Now, a lot of people have got to be brief, yeah?
Yeah, thank you. Professor Blaney, just referring to...
The microphone's not on.
It's on now?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Professor Blaney, thank you. Just referring to your comments on China and then to the two Bibles of the mining industry, the rushes that never ended. Do you think, as a penultimate or before that, volume on your part could be the geopolitical and commercial aspects of the iron ore and coal trade to China and Southeast Asia? Because I feel sure there's a real book in that.
Okay.
You're asking me to write that book?
Yes, this evening.
I think, though I may start it, the chances of my finishing it are not as high as I would hope.
Okay, there's a question here. Let's go. Yep. Now turn
press
it on.
It the top.
Press it.
Push it.
You
said press it.
Okay.
Professor Blaney, I just want, I don't have a question, I want to make a comment. I am a new Australian, have been here only for a few years, but your name and the name of Manning Clark has really been throughout the world, especially with your book, The Tyranny of Distance. And I'm really grateful that I have the opportunity through Sydney Institute that you come here and give us this lecture. And maybe I still have a question. A question would be the tyranny of distance. Do you think that still holds true nowadays in our jet age when you have direct flights from Perth to London in 16 hours? Thank you.
There's the tyranny of distance. Is it still a tyrant? Yes. The conditions offer, the degree of tyranny offer, but distance is still enormously important. And the phrase is now much used in the United States Navy because of the distance between the naval bases of the United States in the East Pacific and the distance between those places and the South China Sea. And one of the great problems of the United States is that it will take a long time to send an armed force from traditional US bases to the potential sea of dispute in the South China Sea. The US Navy see the tyranny of distance as something that is very difficult for them. That's why they've built up Guam, US territory, as a substantial base, so that it still operates, but it's not in the same time scale. That's my view.
You're pretty good at terms. Did you think all these up yourself? Tyranny of distance, for example? How did that come about?
Well, I wrote the book, The Tyranny of Distance, commissioned by Penguin, and in 1965, I didn't have a title for it. I'm very late to think of titles. I think titles are easy, and you think them up when the book is finished. And I still have no title for this book, and I divided the book, the manuscript I'd written, into two parts. The first part was called The Tyranny of Distance, and the second part was called The Taming of Distance. And when I needed a title, I thought, well, The Tyranny of Distance is really more typical than The Taming of Distance. So I took out The Tyranny of Distance from the title of the first half and made it the title of the book. So it was a very slow process by which it arrived. And I didn't like the title myself to start with. I thought it was a bit abstract. My mind likes concrete things. But when people took it up, when the Pope spokesman said, I'm going to conquer the tyranny of distance by coming to Australia in 1971, I thought, what a good title that is.
Questions? Well, okay, so there's a question. Ian McFarlane? Yeah. You can take the microphone, mate. It's on.
Good. The interesting thing about your career, I think, is that you actually set out to be a professional writer, not an academic historian. And I think it was for 12 years that you just eked out a living writing book after book. Did you really think that you were going to be able to spend a whole career just being a writer, without some sort of other secure form of income?
Yes, I did, especially after I wrote for the National Bank, a centenary history. The National Bank of Australasia, as it was called, celebrated its centenary in 1958, and they asked me to write it at very short notice with a very tight deadline. And I asked somebody what fee I would ask, and they said you should ask for £3,000. Which was a lot of money in those days, more than a professor's salary. I went to the man, Rolly Mountain, with whom I dealt at the National Bank, and I said, yes, I'll do it, but it will cost you £3,000. He said, make it 3,000 guineas. So I knew, mistakenly, my future was assured. Could I just add one thing, I should say, that justice must be done to the Aborigines by historians in several respects. I think the most important one was that historians had very little interest in Aboriginal history. The reason largely was that there was no chronology. Before radiocarbon dating, you couldn't give a chronology to Aboriginal history. Nobody knew how long it was. And in 1956, my friend John Mulvaney, he didn't teach me, but he was in the history department at Melbourne University. He set out to conduct the first major archaeological dig in Australia on the banks of the Murray River, upstream from Murray Bridge. And we were very close friends with the family, and he said, I've got no transport. A lot of people didn't have cars soon after they married. I had a second-hand Jowett Javelin, quite a small car, but he said, well, that can take six. So I think there were about 11 people on the expedition, and I took more than half. And so I was there in that remarkable dig where eventually they got the radiocarbon dating, and they found that, I think, Aborigines had been settled there on the banks of the river, I think about 5,000 years ago. That knocked back by a huge margin the tenure of the Aboriginals in this land, and soon it was going back and back. Jim Bowler, a Leongatha boy, by the way, Jim Bowler of the Australian National University, he, with the discovery at Lake Mungo, pushed it back close to 40,000. That's the most astonishing thing in the history of a country, isn't it? That's a most astonishing thing, and I think nothing has done more for people to realise the importance of the Aboriginal phase of our history than the work done by John Mulvaney, of whom I was a chauffeur.
Thanks. I'm just wondering, the IPA have done some research and I'm wondering about identity politics is what the essence of my question. But apparently 147 history subjects, description is identity politics, and the report revealed that not one single Prime Minister is mentioned in any one of the 140 subjects, whereas Pauline Hanson is mentioned three times. So is history really being corrupted in our humanities faculties, or is this a distortion of what's happening out there?
Well, first, before you answer that, just tell us, you then taught at Melbourne University. For how many years did you teach?
I started in the Economic History Department. I taught there from 1962 to the end of 1976. I was professor for the last half of that time, and then in the History Department, the Ordinary History Department, in the Arts Faculty for from 77 to 88.
So the question is, what do you think about teaching of history these days? Just talking to the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's right.
Well, I suppose the difference between Pauline Hanson and the Prime Ministers, who apparently are not mentioned in the syllabus, is she has red hair. if that's true, it's wrong, isn't it? You've got it out of proportion. It's right that you mention her, and very important at certain stages of her history, but if the Prime Ministers are excluded from history, well, there's something wrong, because while in 1901 the state premiers, the premiers of Victoria and New South Wales, were really more powerful than the Prime Minister of Australia, by 1914 the Prime Minister was clearly the number one man in Australia, or woman, and that has grown and grown. And so it's odd that you leave out so much politics, but they've also left out, I think, the Christianity. They've left out the Christianity, and they've left out large numbers of other things. I don't know how accurate that research is. I think one thing that's possibly missing from it, it's not what's on the syllabus of 50 or 100 subjects, it's whether they're important subjects or whether they're subjects which only a few people do. But there's no doubt about it that the teaching of history, to my mind, in schools and universities is a bit skewed.
Okay, we're getting close to the end. Richard?
Professor, when you think about the history of democracy over the last couple hundred years and what's happened in the very recent past, where there seems to be this divisiveness within Western countries for whether it's whatever the reasons are, what's your view on the future of democracy and the ongoing positive development of the West?
Democracy is... modern democracy is a very recent institution. A few Greek cities, some centuries before Christ, developed the first democracies. Bold experiments. You had to live within walking distance or sailing distance of the capital city to take any part in it. You had to be present, actually, at the assembly to have any say in it. Women, of course, had no part. It was a slave-owning society, so it was a very experimental kind of democracy, but one of the great events in the development of Western civilization. A modern democracy is relatively recent. The fact that Australia is one of the oldest continuous democracies in the world, Australia is one of the oldest continuous democracies of the world, is a sign of how young this form of government, in the form we know it, really is. My own view is that, while I'm very much a Democrat, my own view is that democracy is a difficult form of government. We think it's easy, and we blame the politicians, and that's quite right. But we elected the politicians; they've been elected by us, and I think democracy depends not only on having people in seats of power who are doing their best, but it's important that a proportion of the electorate in a democracy should be willing to personally take responsibility for what's happening in society. I'm not saying total responsibility, but democracy depends not only on having
parliamentarians, but it depends on maybe 15 or 20% of the population who really say, well, this is partly my own fault. And democracy depends on that segment of the population. I think that segment of the population has diminished. And one of the profound changes of the last 30 years is the decline of voluntary societies, the decline of the churches in all its forms, the decline of Rotary, all those similar societies, so many voluntary institutions are no longer powerful, and they're training grounds in democracy. They're high points of democracy, just as a well-run parliament is. And democracy is so young, modern democracy, that I wouldn't be surprised if there are only few democracies in the world 100 years' time. I've got no idea, but I wouldn't be surprised if we're alive that there weren't many well-run democracies in 100 years' time. We forget, in what seems a democratic world, that more than half of the nations of the world cannot be called, by any definition, democracies today. More than half. The Economist Intelligence Unit tries to rank democracies. And so I remain optimistic about most human events. I regard the last year since 1945 as probably the most fortunate period in human history, perhaps by a very large margin, using so many different measurements. I've got no idea whether it will continue or not, but there's so much to be optimistic about, but government is difficult. Government is difficult, a difficult activity. Government is much more difficult now than it was in the times of Joseph Lyons or Alfred Deakin, and we should realise that democracy is becoming a more challenging form of government. I remain optimistic, but I remain wary of assuming that democracy will just go on and on. We have to believe in democracy and practice it in our own way. Democracy is government by debate. Democracy is government by discussion. And in our society, often discussion is regarded as not very helpful.
We have room for one final brief exchange. Yep.
Jeffrey, this is your book is about your early life.
Yes, it is.
And what's wonderful about your history is that it grows, and your work on the Indigenous Australian has grown with the carbon dating, so that what you may have written 40, 50 years ago, you would revise it, and you've done that, and that's what's good about it. Could you reflect on your early Jeffrey Blaney mind as a historian and tell us in what ways life and the changes that have gone on over many decades might have changed your perception of how you deal with history?
Well, I can say this, that looking at myself, I started off tackling small-scale subjects. I wrote a lot about mining. Eventually I did mining as a whole, but I wrote a lot about individual institutions. As I became older, I became bolder, and I couldn't have possibly done that when I was age 25 or 30. I didn't have the knowledge or the cheek or the... But I've become bolder and bolder, and I decided I would, for example, when I was about 60, I must write a history of the world. And I kept on putting it off. But I used to, after I ceased to lecture at Melbourne University, whenever a shipping line asked me to lecture on a cruise, I would do it, so long as it wasn't for more than a fortnight or thereabouts. So every year I did about 3 weeks of lecturing. I gained an enormous amount of knowledge. If a shipping line rang up and said, we've got a ship going to Zanzibar and Madagascar, could you lecture? I'd say, of course. That's what I had in mind all along. So I built up a great knowledge of history. And then in 1998, I said, well, I'll make it my main task. And I made it my main task, and I set to work, and eventually I completed it, I think, in the year 2000. I couldn't conceivably do a thing like that when I was age 30 or even age 40, it's like being a carpenter, isn't it? You start off making a coffin and then you you eventually decide, well, I think I can do a house, and after a while you buy some cladding and you do a big building. Your skills and your confidence developed, and your sense of your what are your best abilities and where are your weaknesses, they grow, although not completely. One never knows oneself completely. It's harder to know oneself than to know all kinds of other things. Because the key question in history, I suppose, is about human nature. What are people really like? Do you believe that they're bad, or do you believe that the great number are capable of greatness? That really is the most difficult question. What is human nature like? And I think democracy is based on the idea that human nature is capable of great things, but it's also got great weaknesses. I mean, the essence of democracy is you must accept defeat. The essence of democracy is you must accept defeat. If you're defeated by the vote of the people, you must accept it. Nothing else you can do. In fact, I admired Mr. Shorten in his brief speech after he realised that he was defeated. He said simply, we must accept this defeat. And that's a humbling experience. Humility is part of democracy. If you must accept defeat, even though you believe you're better than anybody else, that is a humbling experience. It's also a humbling experience that you say, well, even though the electorate may not know much, and that's the problem. I think we give away citizenship rather too easily. Why should somebody who's only been in the country 2 or 3 years and doesn't know the language of common discourse, why should they necessarily have the vote if voting is compulsory? So that I've said enough.
So there are a lot of people here, and I'll be very brief. So as I said, we've got copies of Before I Forget, an early memoir. It's a great book, a great read, and I hope you'll come back to the Institute with a later memoir sometime, covering the other half of your life. But for tonight, congratulations on a great performance, and I think it was a performance, and a terrific book, and we'll have you back. But for tonight, well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.